Welcome to Straight Thinking, a GPS for the Christian mind, teaching people how to think, not just what to think. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. On today's podcast, how do we think critically in an age of social media? Well, our guest, Dr. Mark Clark, is here to discuss this topic today. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Joe. It's good to be here.
Thank you. We are in an era of public shaming. How has our world arrived here, and what can we do about it? We're going to address those here with our guest, Mark Clark. Ken, tell us why we have the occasion to have Mark join us today.
Well, Mark is not only an old and good friend of mine and Hugh Ross and Reasons to Believe, but he is a visiting scholar, and he is also a person who was one of the co-authors of our book, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men. So I always tell people that want to know about abduction to go talk to Mark, who's an expert in the field. But Mark and I have been talking over the last couple of weeks about critical thinking, and he had a real good insight about how to approach the topic when it comes to social media. So, Mark, welcome to the program. It's really nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Ken. It's a pleasure to be here. I really appreciate it. Appreciate the opportunity.
Now, you've had a long time association with Reasons to Believe. I remember when you were the co-host of RTB's TBN program, what, 20 years ago?
25, I think.
25 years ago. How did you come to know the Lord, and what was your connection, early connection to RTB?
So I trace coming to the Lord in a couple of steps. When I was in high school, I remember sitting on the back of my father's 57 Chevy pickup, looking at the stars, of all things, and thinking, you know, are we really alone? And this was probably 13. And then at some point in high school, there was a, you know, at the time it was called Jesus People Movement came through. And I remember I raised my hand and accepted Christ. But it was more of an emotional touchstone, I think, in the sense that, you know, I felt really good about it. I really enjoyed it. But that emotional kind of stimulation didn't last. And in retrospect, I can see then something happened, though, because my life started changing. I went in the Marine Corps, and I met a guy in there, and it was very attractive to – he was very intellectual about Christianity. He studied hard. And, you know, in the Marines, you know you're going to get some guff. So I think I put him through kind of a torture chamber of tests for a year to test it out and to see, can this withstand me personally? And then I remember specifically one night – we had bunks. I was on a ship, and I was reading some of the literature about Christianity, and – a guy that had come on with this friend of mine named Todd, by now he'd gone pretty rough in the other way. He'd gone, you know, he's living with a woman off base, and he's pretty obnoxious. And I'll paraphrase, are you reading that junk too? And my initial response was, no, I was just looking at it, turned the light out. And the Lord just kind of put a mirror up to my soul and said, you're tough on the outside. You score well in the Marines. You're doing physically great, but you're a moral coward. And I thought, whoa. Lord, I turned the light back on and I said, yeah, I am. So that was kind of and that's why I put it in three parts. There was kind of an initial awareness, then the message of Christianity that kind of sank in my soul. And I could see in retrospect later that my life, my soul, my thoughts, my morale, because I didn't grow up with any frame of reference for it at all. We didn't go to church.
Okay.
So that kind of was the beginning of the process. When I went to graduate school, I was at USC studying particularly defense and strategic studies, and I remember feeling this kind of schizophrenia. I'd heard about this young earth view, and I had kind of held to it, but it created a set of problems for me at school. I could be an intellectual at school because, you know, I loved it. I was good at research. I liked writing on the subject matter. I think the Lord's timing with me going to study strategic studies, having been in the Marines, become a Christian in the Marines, really integrated the two things I was most passionate about. But the basic argument that I was left with was, well, if science is all wrong, and I know how hard my scholarship is, and we're nowhere near the level of astronomy, mathematics, and things like that, I thought, it creates a schizophrenia. You know, you can be a Christian at home, so I'd read C.S. Lewis and things like that, and I could be a good scholar at work, but I could not integrate the two. And then I went to a Bible study that Hugh was offering, and it was actually a 10 or 11-week course, 9-week course, on evolution and creation. I went in with the attitude, you know, he's probably in error, but, you know, I'm going to help him and this and that. Within a class and a half, I realized I had no idea what I was talking about. So from that point on, I began studying his, going to his class, and then I began to volunteer as an apologist with the ministry on a phone apologetics in the early days.
Yeah.
And then Hugh asked if I'd be a co-host on his show. And you know, because I wasn't trained in astrophysics and quantum mechanics, I called myself the intellectual crash dummy for Hugh and for every guest that came on. Mm-hmm. And that was my role, is can I understand it, and can I kind of imagine what they're saying in a way that makes it even more accessible to the audience.
And yeah, you did a good job with that. That's a tough show to do.
It was tough, especially when Erica and Matt Carlson came on and they talked quantum mechanics, and yeah. I had to repeat that. I got it, but I walked away thinking, I don't remember what I said or how I did it. It was tough.
Hmm. Well, very good, Mark. On this show, we emphasize the importance of critical thinking. We like to tell people not just what you need to think, but we try to say, hey, here's a tool chest of tools that you can help you in your thinking. It seems to me that social media poses challenges when it comes to thinking carefully and thinking critically. So introduce us to this topic of being a critical thinker on social media.
Sure, it's a sort of a complex thing, but I would say that, you know, I think I just looked at Pew Research, and there's a lot of evidence out there now that a lot of Americans are concerned about social media. And they're concerned in the sense that more than 50% of us get our news through social media platforms, and we're concerned about the biases that come through that. And Joe, you mentioned public shaming. It's interesting, with the rise of social media, we've now seen the rise of something that was outlawed in the United States and in Great Britain over 180 years ago, public shaming. And it kind of coincides with this kind of polarization in our politics, but particularly in our civil discourse. Our civil discourse is going to opposite poles at this time. It's no longer civil. And I don't blame it all on social media by any stretch, because there are both good and bad things from social media. And some of the good things, you know, there's a rise of interconnectedness, right? There's the ability, like reasons, to stay in contact with constituents and people who are interested. I have an ability to stay connected with my alumni who have gone on to work for law enforcement, intelligence community, military operations that are overseas, SEAL members, you know, across the spectrum. So there's very good things. Twitter, and actually a former student of mine who worked for the CIA, sent me an article. One of the big challenges you have, particularly as an analyst, is to get to the point right away. And a good writer, the same thing, right? Don't belabor the point. Get to the issue. And so she sent me this article that they used internally. And it was, the good thing about Twitter is that by constraining you to 140 characters, you now have to get to the point faster and more concisely. So that's to the good. The challenge is, however, and I mentioned public shaming, is that social media has some interesting paradoxical problems. Although there's this rise of interconnectedness, a lot of studies are showing there's also an increase in the level of social anxiety, loneliness, yeah. despair, depression, and it in particular affects young, particularly females, but a lot of people, not just young women, but in particular young women. And more to the point, a lot of social researchers have documented this kind of decrease in human empathy towards other people, to the point now it's 40% less than it was before the age of social media began. That people coming to college have much less empathy for the other human being. Mm. So I've been thinking about it for a while, and my thesis has been for some time that it ought to be us Christians who try to do something about this. And I take great comfort from the fact that historically we've had a huge impact on culture. In the Western culture, where Christianity once was predominant, there's still this kind of other-centered based thinking, that ethic, I should call it. And in the examples given, Bernard Lewis, a great Middle East historian, talked about it in a lecture he gave in 2007 at a conference, an Association for the Study of Middle East and Africa. And it's on our asmiascholars.org webpage. Fascinating thing. He talks about how, because scholars in the Middle Ages studied ancient languages, they were interested in the authors, they were interested in their viewpoint, there was a lot to be gained. There was a whole kind of cultural shift. We're no longer interested in the other just to use them, but because throughout the world, most people, the only time they looked at another culture was to take something from them or enslave them or whatever. But now it's the other is valuable on the other's sake. And that's based on the Imago Dei, right? That's a Christ-centered ethic. And I would argue that if you, and this is Tim Keller brings this up in his book, The Reason for God, that if you talk to anyone today, any young person, why would you not hurt another person? Say an older woman walking across the street, and they would say, because she's a nice person. What do I have to do with her? But a shame, honor-based culture would not do it. They have a decent ethic, but it's not the same. It would be because, well, that would bring dishonor to our family or to me. And so because of that historical impact we've had, I think we can have an historical impact. And I'm borrowing from you, Ken. You talk about the golden rule of apologetics. I think we ought to think about the golden rule of social media.
Well, very good, Mark. It seems to me that a lot of these things that plague us right now have always been around. I mean, people have challenging families, the broken heart, the brokenness of the human condition has been around a long time, since the fall. But it does seem that this enterprise, this social media, kind of enhances some of these kinds of issues, that technology kind of exposes maybe the weaknesses that we have in life. So talk to us then a little bit about how do we conduct ourselves? What do you suggest? How can we be more positive and affirming in what we do? Because even though I was reluctant to get involved with social media, I couldn't deny that there are a lot of people out there.
Correct. Yeah, it's a huge phenomenon. And I would just add, if you talk to anyone that's looking at issues of like 5G, the spread, that's going to enhance the Internet of Things. And every day, 4 million new devices are being attached to that Internet of Things. So, and the platforms for social media, different WhatsApp and all the various platforms are expanding as well. I think you're right. I think one of the things that I would say is that it's not social media that's the problem, it's the human condition.
Yeah.
And I think that's the fundamental issue, is that it amplifies in some respects some of the worst traits of us. And when I analyze the issues with social media, the problems, and I think there's 5 or 6 major problems that we can talk about later, probably the key thing is that 80%, and you talk to anyone in psychology, in psychiatry, or neuroscience, 80% of our communication is nonverbal. We're sitting around a table, we're looking at each other, we're seeing our expressions. In the audience, they're not hearing or seeing, or they're hearing us, but they're not seeing that. So there's a significant fraction of our actual human communication is missing. And this is why you see people who feel sort of like they're behind a wall. They can do things and say things that they otherwise wouldn't. Because if I said something insulting to you, Ken, you would give me a strange look. You might hit me. No, I'm just kidding. I know you better than
Not
that.
Not too hard.
Okay, yeah, peacefully, right? but I would see the look in your face, and I would say, well, wait a minute. Maybe I made a mistake, or I told a joke that was inappropriate, right? And that's where social media kind of amplify some of the worst features of us. We don't have any moderating influence, if that makes sense.
There's one thing, your comment about Twitter, that you come to the point very quickly, and this is advantageous. But the destructive part of it is that I'm coming to the point, you're a jerk, rather than explain some particular reason why I disagree with you.
And I would absolutely agree with that. I mean, there's strengths and limitations to everything, right? Unintended consequences. But I think, and I want to, if we can, just talk about this. So I want to make a distinction between analytical thinking, logical fallacies, how you take apart things. And one of the things that I do, and critical thinking, and let me make an illustration of that. I think it'll help. I teach my students one of the basic level, and this is grad students. Unfortunately, I don't think we professors do a really good job about this in a lot of fields, not just mine.
Tell us where you teach. I think we didn't complete your bio at the beginning.
That's right.
Sure. I've been a professor for 30 years at California State University in San Bernardino, and I've been with a master's program in national security studies. About 6 years ago, I got a National Science Foundation grant to establish a second master's degree in national cybersecurity studies. And we're trying to teach people to give technical skills but be able to communicate it to non-technical people, if that makes sense.
Yep.
So analytical thinking, one of the things, and Mortimer Adler, someone that you recommended years ago.
Yeah, my hero.
Great. I use Mortimer Adler's How to Read a Book, and we look at the third level, the analytical thinking or reasoning. And so there's essentially eight elements of all arguments and reasoning. There's, you know, the author's point of view, the data that the author uses or doesn't use, inferences that can be drawn from it. But the key one, and the one that I think students have the hardest time both identifying in an author and identifying in their own reasoning, is what assumptions am I holding?
Very good.
So that's good, and we'll have a little test here in a minute because I think it'll be useful to help maybe our audience think about this. Critical thinking, however, is not negative thinking per se. It is thinking about thinking. It's understanding our cognitive strengths and limitations. And I can share some work from a scholar in my field, Robert Jervis, who actually borrows from cognitive psychology to talk about some of the elements of reasoning that go on and why it's both efficient but also has some inherent flaws. But that's the starting
okay,
point.
Okay, very
so,
good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one of the things I like to do, it's kind of fun, I'm going to talk about this one from Robert Jervis and his famous work, Perception and Misperception in International Politics. And his goal there was, if you think about what was the question the author was asking, that's another one of those eight elements of reasoning, was how do we determine when a leader is making a foreign policy decision or a military decision that's rational or irrational? So he's borrowing from cognitive psychology. Until the development of cognitive psychology, it tended to be behavioralist. So it, you know, rats in a maze, right? They're incentives and disincentives. But that doesn't get into the human mind. So he develops it this way. He says, look, from computer science, we have an analog to how the human reasoning occurs. And he said there's five elements. Basically, people construct their own image of reality. And the reason for that is not postmodernism, okay? So don't take it, because reality is crucial in this view. But it's that we are limited to fragments of information. And this is particularly true when you talk to people who are working in the intelligence field. We're overwhelmed with information. We're overwhelmed with social media information.
Sure.
We're overwhelmed with news platforms. So we tend to construct our images. And this is a kind of the analogous to the work of archaeologists and paleontologists. We have an incomplete picture, so we kind of flesh it out, and we kind of imagine it. During second part of this reasoning structure that Jervis talks about is during our maturing, everyone acquires a set of beliefs or images or theories about things. A simple example I give students is, you know, when you're young, you see something with wings and it flies. And then you see another version of the same thing and it flies. And you see, you know, 20 different kinds of birds and you think, well, all birds fly. You know, naturally infer this until you meet your first penguin. You know, you can't overwhelm a kid with too much information or anyone. But you have these set of beliefs. And they actually do studies where they say that seeing would be impossible without it. In fact, people who were blind from birth, who gained their sight through whatever means, have a long time adjusting to the real world because in their mind they've constructed their own images, and just as we do. So it takes time for us to engage the real world. And then third, they point out this construction of our experience is highly selective. And it's important because we can be overwhelmed by sense impressions. Psychologists have pointed out that in a lot of spectrums, including short-term memory in terms of hearing or listening, and so sensory impressions, visual impressions, there's what they call the magic number, 7 ±2. We can only keep 7 ±2 memories in our short-term memory, and we can only actually process 7 ±2 images or sounds at the same time. And I use it in class, you know, you think about it, there's the ticking of the clock, there's cars outside, there's noise from the air conditioner, there's people writing, people clicking, professor talking, PowerPoint. You can filter out a lot of that, which is important. But this leads to probably one of the most interesting things is that people, and Jervis points this out, is we tend to see what we expect to see. This shows some of the tendencies we have, not that we always do, but it's why we don't see our typos in our own essays when we write them.
Yeah, wow.
You know, it's why we need people to look at our material, why we need someone to review our speech before we give it so we don't.
And these, of course, open us to these biases that are there.
Yes, and one of the lead ones, of course, is it comes from a problem that we have. It's called satisficing, and I think you've heard that term. It's a neologism from sufficient and satisfactory. Whenever we see something new, we come to kind of the most first reasonable hypothesis about it. The problem is we don't consider all the other evidence because we can't. We can't. Our minds, we have to engage in real life, right? And it's not bad. It's an efficient way of thinking, but it also has its tendencies, its problems.
Yeah.
And satisficing, if you're not aware of it, can lead to hypothesis-confirming biases, right? So, all right, I've anchored my belief that certain things happen a certain way all the time. And, boy, I am now willing to ignore discordant evidence.
Yeah.
And I only search for evidence that confirms hypothesis-confirming bias.
Yeah, right.
In his great book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, John Ronson wrote a very funny thing in that. And he said, ever since I first heard about the hypothesis-confirming bias, I've been seeing it everywhere.
Very good.
So, and then the fifth, the last thing on this, people assimilate information to their pre-existing beliefs. And we tend to shape, warp that information so it fits with what we know. And then once formed, those beliefs or images are hard to change. Now, what's cool about that is, in a way, it's an efficient way. And Jervis says, don't knock it. It's efficient. If we're not theory-driven in our thinking, if we are data-driven in everything, we can't get anything done. You know, paralysis by analysis. So everyone, especially leaders, by the time they get to public office, by the time they make decisions, they've already got a set of beliefs about how the Russians work or how the Chinese work or how the Iranians or whatever it is. And it's really interesting. The corollary to the tendency to see what we expect to see is that it takes more information and more unambiguous information to recognize unexpected phenomena. And this is key, because why is it that we get policy surprises? Why is it we get intelligence surprises? It's because of that fact, that it's very difficult to happen. So mindsets or beliefs or images are tend to form quickly but are resistant to change. Give a classic example I use for my students. I have a theory or a belief that my wife loves me. If I go home tonight after teaching a long class and she's in a grumpy mood, I don't think it's me. I think, what happened to your day? But if after 3 months I come home and she's still in a grumpy mood, I better start looking. It could be me, right? And so the same thing, if a policy is not working, if what we're doing is not working after a long time, then there's something wrong with what we're doing. And I think that's important for social media. What we're doing is problematic, right? We're all thinking that it's okay to publicly shame people. And some of the cases that John Ronson, that name is like two first names being used.
Yeah, yeah.
It's hard to remember.
The other way.
Yeah. He points out that when he did analysis of different cases, that people absolutely delighted in tearing down a person. Mm. Absolutely took delight in that. And that's not helping civil discourse. In fact, now you have the polls, the political parties are tending towards that extreme as well, where it's not that there shouldn't be division. Our constitutional structure meant for divisions and different ways to constrain one another from power, right? But it's that now we regard the other as either unpatriotic, immoral, inhuman, maybe evil, and you really see it sometimes in social media.
Mark, I like to say that the best evidence for original sin are anonymous comments on the web.
Wow. That's pretty good.
That is, well, you know what's funny is I gave a talk on this yesterday to the staff, and a couple people came up and showed some of the stuff that happened to them. And it's, yeah, it's out there. It's just we face it daily, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things I want to do is the assumption part, if that's okay.
I'm going to move into
that. And I don't want to take from your guys' interest, but I did this yesterday with a test, and I want to hear what your responses are here. So I'm going to give a simple statement. In the audience, I want you to think of the same thing, and then we'll talk about it. So think of the very first thing that you think of when I make the statement, a man lying in a gutter. What'd you think, Ken?
Addiction, poverty.
Okay. Dave?
An accident.
Okay. Joe?
I already gave my answer. Homeless.
Homeless, yes. That was yesterday, yeah. When I was walking with, I took a friend out and I was talking to him, kind of mentoring him, a younger gentleman. We were on a hike and I kind of brought this up and he goes, oh, murdered. Someone's been murdered. And so when I explained, what's interesting is that's a simple fact, right? A man lying in a gutter, there's no context to it. There's no other information. Yeah. And yet we make different inferences.
Yeah. Right. We fill in the gaps
because information is incomplete and we do it with assumptions. And that's how we make inferences. In just this room, we have three different inferences. So at least three different, you know, assumptions. And I'm sure in the audience they've had the same kind of thing. So it's important to pay attention to the fact that we have that. I would say it's even more important to pay attention to the fact, and this will be harder for our audience to visualize, but I'm going to do it anyway, see if we can do it. I'm going to repeat a phrase several times, and maybe this won't work with people in the audience and listening, but I want to see what it works with you guys and see what happens here, okay?
We're crash dummies.
Intellectual crash dummies. There you go. And Joe participated in it, so I'm kind of curious. I didn't hear what you said yesterday.
Make sure you use the word crash ahead of that second word.
Yes, I
even like when you put the intellectual before that.
Well, you did, didn't you? Well, that's not very philosophical of you, Ken. So I'm going to repeat a word three times, and then I'm going to pause and give you another word. And I want you to think where you feel it in your body. Because this is important, especially when we talk about social media. No. 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 And now, yes. 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 What'd you feel?
Wow. Well, the no hit me hard. It was like a punch.
Where, in your chest?
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting? Dave?
I guess so. You know, I think that I can't say that I had a visceral reaction to it, but you know, you think of saying no to your dog or something, yeah, or to your
that's
kids.
What I thought,
sure. So it's, yeah.
You know, it's an intensity kind of thing.
It's an intensity, yeah. Yeah. And so you saw my face, but here we know each other, so it's harder to make this work.
Right.
In a bigger audience, it's a little easier. Joe, did you have any reaction yesterday?
Yeah, I did. And I think somebody commented, you kind of feel it in your core area. That's where I felt it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what's fascinating is if you think of the brain, the amygdala, which is part of the limbic system, which is just above the brainstem and underneath the cortex, with our prefrontal cortex, we think long range. We think of consequences once it's fully developed. But our amygdala acts and reacts milliseconds faster than our prefrontal cortex. And so when something sounds threatening, we go into a fight or flight reaction immediately, and that's why you feel it in your body to some extent. Again, it's hard here because you guys know me and all that, but essentially it's a response, a defense mechanism meant to help us survive. But it makes inferences faster and more inaccurately and assumptions faster and more inaccurately than even our prefrontal cortex. So if we make assumptions already with incomplete information, we are really going to make it when we feel threatened or outraged. And that's key because social media, a lot of this stuff plays to the outrage in us. And it's trying to trigger what psychologists, psychiatrists would call dysregulation in a human being. Dan Siegel, professor, or he's a clinical research psychiatrist at UCLA, he calls it flipping our lids.
Flipping our lids.
You like that?
Yeah.
Have you ever flipped your lid?
I have.
On social media?
Well, I've tried to
avoid it.
Tried to limit it.
Moderate. Yes.
Yeah. For people who wear toupees, you better not do that.
Or at least get some double stick tape underneath there so it can't manage it.
Oh, boy.
So yeah, so I think, you know, there's some cases that we could look at that where you see people flip their lid and it was completely inaccurate. Do you remember last January, the Covington High School event? I don't know if you recall that.
Yeah.
Some kids from a private Christian high school Catholic high school went to a pro-life rally, and there was another people on the other side. And then there was this group of, I think they're called Black Israelite Nation or something like that. They're a group of, no one knows what they believe because they're kind of a very, you know, secretive sect or something.
Okay.
But they were shouting obscenities and they were kind of making all this ruckus. And they were there just standing there. And the way the media reported, and it hit me, and I mentioned this yesterday, when I first heard about it, I heard about it on KNX, one of our local radio stations. And I heard the way it was phrased was, and the ultimate thing was that there was an older Indian man there. The way it was phrased was students that support Trump confronting a tribal elder. And it hit me and it angered me and it frustrated me and I thought, this is wrong. What are they doing? But then all of a sudden, wow, it turned out it wasn't true. Mm-hmm. The 16-year-old's depicted with, and they has a number of students behind him, one or more has a red MAGA cap on it. People that looked at it actually reacted on what they assumed rather than the actual fact. In fact, analysts or a lot of the journalists themselves said, we were wrong. I failed the Covington Catholic test. I'm tired of my involvement in toxic public debate. And others did another mea culpa. They went and they looked at the two-hour video, and the things that were claimed that had happened didn't happen. In fact, the 16-year-old boy that was the one that was depicted in the video was probably being more grown up, more mature than all the adults around him. And the tribal elder said he was a Vietnam veteran. Turned out he wasn't that either. So the whole narrative spun wildly on social media, on regular media, and it was completely inaccurate. And it was because there was a sense, this assumption that outrage, right? Anything that can happen with this group is going to be outrageous, and they went away. Another one that I think is fascinating and sad, but it's even worse, Justine Sacco. I don't know if you've heard of her. I know you have, Joe. But this was a woman that worked for a PR firm magazine, a PR section of a magazine, and she was on a trip. She was going to Johannesburg. But she had, I think at the time, 170 Twitter followers. And if you looked at Google searches of her, she had maybe 200 hits in September, 200 in her name, that is, in October and November. In December of 2013, my bad, she flies to Heathrow and lands, and in between she tweets to her friends, you know, poor quality jokes, but funny, right, about smelly Germans who don't take baths, who ride in first class. And another one about, you know, bland British food. And no hits, no responses. And then she, you know, nothing happens. She decides to get on the plane and go to Johannesburg. And she, before she turns off her phone, she tweets one more time, I'm going to Africa. I hope I don't get AIDS. Guess I can't, though. I'm white. Boom. Turned off her phone.
Moo.
Yes. And, you know, this woman was a young, kind of progressive, you know, you name it, all the right credentials. She was excoriated on social media. She started with 170 followers, ended up with hundreds of thousands who were belittling her, berating her, saying some of the most vile things you can imagine. They even developed a new hashtag, Has Justine Landed Yet? And they posted it and then put it on a flight tracker for her so that people in Johannesburg confronted her when she got off the plane. And she had to turn around immediately, go incognito, and fly right back home. And she lost her job, and it took her several years before she could recover her life. No one asked her, what did you mean by that joke? Because that's that human communication, the 8%. No one saw how, I didn't mean it that way, but it didn't matter. She was deemed worse than something like an Adolf Hitler in that moment. From that point, Google had, you know, she had never been cited much. Afterwards, she had been cited over 2 million times in that one brief two-week period of time because of that. So now, it was a poor quality joke, certainly no doubt. But had she said it in the context of friends, people would have looked at her like, what are you talking about? Again, that 80% of nonverbal communication was completely absent on social media, and people pounced and were outraged and fed into the outrage of others and created this vicious cycle.
And there seems as well, Mark, there seems to be, you know, people don't... People may not want to take time to try to logically persuade or, hey, you know, maybe I want to try to bring a different perspective politically to you. It seems like what we have in a lot of those contexts, instead of me trying to reason you into maybe what I think is a more rational point of view, no, I want to hurt you. I want to put you in a position where anybody who believes what you believes gonna get pain and suffering. Your job is gonna be lost. I'll show up at the restaurant where you are and, you know, shout you down. That's
shame you out of
Yeah,
we do see a lot of that, and it's kind of frightening. So, you know, those are two examples, and if you don't mind, I'll go, you know, my assessment is that part of the problem with social media is, you know, the 80% is nonverbal is the biggest, most important. But there's other parts. You know, there is, especially if more and more Americans are getting their media through social media, there's no journalistic process in social media, right? There's no fact-checking that happens. Yeah. And these cases illustrate it. You know what's interesting about the journalists that actually did a mea culpa on, you know, their involvement, that they had failed and they shouldn't have been contributing this way, they should have done more checking, they were excoriated on the thread afterwards, which is stunning. It's like they don't care about facts, the people who are engaged in it. They care about humiliating people. But there is no journalistic process, and that's a problem. But journalism, even with its processes, which are good, tends to focus on what we call negative news, right? New York Times years ago said, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah.
And I brought this up, too, and it's kind of an interesting thing. Think about it. If you're at home and your spouse calls you and says, when you get home, I need to talk, and that's all you hear, what happens?
You think, what do I do now?
Exactly. We tend to go to the negative. The human mind is structured that way.
Yeah.
Or if your boss's assistant comes in and taps on your door, hey, your boss needs to see you right now. You don't go to a happy place.
Maybe he's
going to
give me a raise.
Yeah. Have you ever thought that?
No.
You know, it's funny you mention that, because when my wife texts me, I don't see the verbal communication. And for the sake of brevity, she'll say, we need to talk about something. So I'm reacting like Dave, so I call her because I'm worried right then and there. It's like, what do we need to talk about? Oh, it can wait till later. It's no big deal. Well, why did you
tell me that? Yeah. It's funny. I had something like that happen with the dean. You know, you said, hey, I wanted to call you and your chair in, and we're going to talk about something. But I'm not going to do to you what my wife has done to me, which is not tell you what that's about. And I thought, thank you. You're a good guy. I really appreciate that. So anyway, so that's the second thing. Social media, too, also has developed the addictive thing of called likes, right? And so people seek likes.
Yeah.
If you look at that Storm Area 51 thing, the crazy event that was supposed to take place in September, I was asked to comment on it.
Tell us a little bit more for those who are not familiar with that.
Sure. There was this some guy, Matty Roberts, I think it was, that started this. Hey, let's go Storm Area 51, this place out in the desert near Vegas. And they can't stop us all. We can Naruto run, which is from a Japanese anime character. If you're, you got to go look it up. I never understood. I don't watch anime. I didn't know what a Naruto run was. It still doesn't make any sense, but it was kind of cute. But he actually got over 2 million likes on it, and 700 so that said that they would attend, and 600,000 said they were interested. And when he realized it's going to be a big thing, and the FBI said, hey, are you really serious about this? And the military, the Air Force, put out a warning, said, no, this is classified stuff we're doing here. What was fascinating is he wrote, hey, I just want to get some likey-likeys, Mr. Fed, sorry. And it's like, you know, he started something that actually grew, and it fizzled. The actual event fizzled because it's in the middle of the desert. It's 70 miles northwest of Vegas. There's nasty rattlesnakes out there.
Right.
There's no porta-potties. The town, The whole county is 5,000 people. That could have been overwhelming had it happened. But it was that addictive quality of likes that he was pushing and that other people jumped onto. And then finally, social media has flow. You know, it tries to keep you engaged beyond what's reasonable, what's normal. And this is particularly true, you see, with YouTube. And then finally, to me, the 80% nonverbal communication that we all engage in. Psychologists and psychiatrists that do, and especially those who are involved in neuroscience, say, you know, our brains are not really that independent. Our minds are not really that. We are so much more, our lives are more contingent upon our interactions, our communities, the friends, families, children, colleagues that we interact with. We shape each other. We influence one another. It's not that we live in isolation. And especially the Christian community should be good about that in an encouraging way. Mm. So trying to do church through social media would have some of those limitations. It's missing some of those elements that are crucial to understanding, I think.
Right.
But just social media itself does that. So, and I think, too, there's going to be a new phenomenon that's coming up soon, and I talked about it a little bit yesterday, but deep fakes. And I don't know if you've heard about deep fakes, but it's this new phenomenon that's coming out. There's Google, for example, has created a couple of artificial intelligence agents trying to create a fake video where you can't disprove it. You can't show that it's fake. And then it has another interactive artificial intelligence machine trying to find flaws in it and feed back those flaws so that they can create really genuine fakes. Now, you can imagine this is great for entertainment and all that, but it could have some really serious consequences, especially with the Russian interference in the 2016 election. We think it's going to happen to our elected officials probably sooner rather than later, maybe by next election cycle, 2020, certainly after that. So imagine getting ready to go to the voting booth, and it's a Sunday, voting's on Tuesday, and all of a sudden your favorite candidate's depicted in a horrific crime behind the scenes, and no one can disprove it. It takes some weeks or months to disprove. what'll happen, or especially if it hits particular constituents, constituencies. You know, he's a noted supporter of women's rights, and so a lot of people are supporting him, and then he's having an illicit affair or, you know, something like whatever it could be. Yeah. So that's the fear, and I know the intelligence community is really concerned about this for the election, but what's interesting, it's already occurring, and it's usually hurting the weakest members of society. And so, for example, a number of famous women, either actresses or other kinds of ways, are being depicted in pornographic movies and spread out to either publicly humiliate them, and they're on the defensive for this. And it's like, this is a shame, and you know it's going to affect our kids. So that is something to not look forward to. It's something to be concerned about and to assess that as we move forward, we better start getting a handle on thinking critically. And how do we do that? And how do we manage these things? So, you know, in China is now engaged in the recent Hong Kong protest. And the social media giants are now trying to, you know, anticipate how this is going to happen. And China posted a number of YouTube channels were shut down by YouTube because they were seen to be coordinated fashion. Almost 1,000 Twitter accounts were shut down because they were clearly coming from mainland China, and they were trying to portray China as being restrained, the protesters as being aggressive and violent, trying to influence external perceptions of their internal world. So how do we do this? How do, you know, so here's some thoughts. I don't know where we are in this process.
I have a question.
Sure, absolutely.
Unplug the internet.
I know some people that are doing that. Yeah. It's as I mentioned earlier, I think the platforms for social media, the idea of the anonymity, that you can hide behind it, and you know, with virtual private networks and, you know, ways to, you know, I don't know if you know, there's different apps that you can do. It can be completely encrypted so they can't track the source of it. The message can disappear. You can set it to disappear. So it'll be interesting to see if they start using this with social media, public shaming, so it's even greater anonymity. It's not just now I'm, you know, Twitter rat 131 at whatever. It's you can't even know who I am. And so a lot of this responsibility and checking is going to be gone, further removed. So I don't know who gets the time to express this kind of outrage. I've got too much to do. I don't know about you guys. It's like, you know, life's too complicated, and there's so much information out there already. It's sad, but it's something that it's a nuisance, but we have to figure out a way to do it. And I think there's a couple ways. I think one of the ways is to, if you feel that sense that you had when I said no, if you feel that little bit of outrage on anything that's being posted, you probably are in the midst of someone trying to provoke rage. And if so, or whatever, you may be flipping your lid, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's time, I would say, you know, Dan Siegel tells parents when children do this, when teenagers do this, give them a chance to pause and kind of get their prefrontal cortex back online. I have this. I've had this policy with my friend and colleague for 18 years now, Brian Janiski. He and I have for years worked to each other. If one or the other of us gets hit with some really harsh statement by someone or some outrageous thing or whatever, we spend time. We call each other. We visit each other, and we try to give alternatives. We think through. You know, the person that's not being affected will spend time. Well, have you thought this could be happening? We're trying to help him. Each other, bring our PFC back online to reduce the outrage, show some alternatives, and then at the last we say, all right, if you need it, take 24 hours before you make a decision. Or the weekend, if it's really big, like you're going to quit your job or you're going to quit being chair because I don't want to be chair again. You know, something really important, you want them to take time. And we've done that for each other, and I think maybe we have to encourage other believers in particular to engage in that kind of process with one another, help one another to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, Mark, that when I'm on social media, let's say Facebook, I guess Twitter would work as well. It seems like I recognize that the psychology changes. That is, if I'm having a conversation with you, we're alone and we're talking, but on the web or on particularly Facebook, now there are all these people listening. And I've seen that both myself and others operate differently if I have an audience. Mm-hmm. You know, I may want to be funny all the time. I may want to come off with some kind of sarcastic humor, or I may want to, you know, look good. And I've even noticed that when I'll write a comment, and let's say I'm disagreeing with somebody, and the person who's disagreeing puts their, and then a person likes what they said, it's like, wow, there's this emotional kind of context.
Sure.
And I wonder if people would act that way if they were, whether they would say the things they say or seemingly say it the way I think they intend it if we were alone. I don't think that they would. I think they would move in a different kind of direction. But the psychology, and I guess that goes back to a point you made very early, and that is that Aristotle defined logic as ordered thought. But you see, I'm more than just a purely rational individual. God gave me emotions. I have instincts. I think at times I have a vision of the way reality is, but I'm more than just that rational component, and that kind of comes out on social media.
Yeah, and I think you're right. By the way, did you take the red or the blue pill? I want to know, because I think you were quoting Matrix there. Well, I think one of the key things is when you see something that hurts you or is offensive or potentially creates outrage or you know, your response, you know, the first question I ask, especially if I feel that, is to, okay, what assumptions am I holding?
Yeah.
Is this person an enemy? Are they a friend? Are they trying to help me? Or are they trying to hurt me? You know, and then think it through. But also, again, because 80% of communication is nonverbal, there isn't that social, visual context clue or to the talk. So I strongly recommend, I think the golden rule of social media engagement is, if you feel outrage, give it time. Think about what you're assuming. Talk with someone about it before you respond, because instinctually you're going to want to respond and hit back. But let's do unto others the way we would like to be treated.
Give them the benefit of the doubt.
Of the doubt. If you don't want to assume, if you don't want to be have everyone assume that you're a knucklehead, don't treat them like one, right?
Yeah.
And you've talked about that with apologetics, and I think it's true here. And I mean, you know, again, what's missing in our conversation? If you know the person or know of the person, try to do a sidebar conversation, a message, and talk to them, because, you know, those are important things. This happened when Gina passed. Gina Donnelly, one of the members of staff here, you know, along with 8 other people had gone on a trip with her to Canada, and we'd hiked all over glaciers and did, you know, with your wife was there and some other members of the ministry. And she recently passed away, and I was so sad. I posted something on Facebook in memoriam, just some pictures of her, nothing else. And, you know, one pastor did it right. He called, and you guys would know him. He stopped by the ministry a few times, Tim Peck. He called and said, "Hey, Mark, what happened to Gina?" And that was the right approach, right? Talk to the person, find out. And most people, you know, had heard about it or not, but a couple hadn't and said, "Really snippy, without contacting me, shouldn't you wait for the family to post and blah, 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 blah." And it's just this real snippy, no one talked to me. And it's like, you know, so I shut it down and I reposted it when I saw there was a lot more people, because everyone was posting about it and it wasn't just me. It was a real sad thing. So I think for me, the way to think about it is, I think, you know, when you teach logic and when you teach reasoning, it's, you have to slow things down. I think we need to be aware that we need to slow things down as we engage in social media.
So this is deliberating. I mean, I often suggest to people, look, if you put something on the web or on social media, it's going to be there a long time.
Yes.
You want to think a little bit about it. And also something else you mentioned, I mean, my first gut reaction to something isn't always the right one.
Correct.
I need to step back and say, okay, let me shift from how I feel about that to maybe more of a logical, analytical approach. How should I kind of deal with that? Because I'm always thinking, I may not be able to connect with this individual. Maybe we have some strong differences, but there are a lot of people listening, and I wonder, how are they going to come away? You know, even if they don't necessarily buy my argument, they may say, you know, even when I differ with Ken, he's reasonable. He gives, he defers to people. I think that's very important, Mark.
And I've seen you do it a lot on your social media stuff, and I appreciate how you say thank you for that observation or that insight. You're very good about that, and I think we need to model that, all of us, more and more, and not model the bad kind, especially as Christians. I know Christians do the bad kind, right? we ought not to be the ones doing that.
I like your emphasis on the golden rule. That's going to be my takeaway from this podcast. And it's consistent with what the scientists here at RTB say about technology. Technology, science, these are tools. They can be used for however we want to use them, but they're simply tools. And this goes way back, Ken. You've talked about this before in the podcast with the invention of the printing press. Christians ran with that and got the Bible disseminated everywhere. I think that's happened with all kinds of things, radio, TV, and so on. So these are tools for our use, and we can go one way or the other, perhaps.
Right. I would agree. I think, you know, again, it's just a tool, an instrument. I mean, I had this challenge in a paper in college, one of my first classes, and it was, you know, guns are evil, right? And I said, no, it's like aspirin. It can be misused or used well. And the professor, you know, didn't like that, but thought it was a reasoned argument. But I think social media is the same way. It's just a tool. And the problem is some things manifest like guns, the evil in people, and social media at times, right? So is it the tool or is it the human condition? And that's where we need to be, in the human condition.
You know, Mark, I was thinking as well, when it comes to technology, you know, you might see a policeman is involved in a shooting, and you see somebody filming it, maybe on their cell phone. It's funny to me how many things people do with their cell phones other than call people, you know. But somebody will take a video of a policeman that's involved in a fight or a protest or some type of shooting. But when you see it, you're getting a very often limited perspective. But then when you hear the policeman talk and say, well, here is what I saw, and this is how I interpreted this, and this is what my training is, and these were my concerns. But a lot of times we think, hey, I saw it on TV. I'm going to make a judgment call. When in reality, the camera doesn't interpret anything.
No, and like any instrument, it's got its strengths and its limitations, you know, and it doesn't have that context that's important, too.
Well, this is very good. I there's a couple things that just have stood out to me as you were talking, Mark, that being deliberate is what I would call being reflective. You know, I'm gonna step back for a moment and recognize that I have certain tendencies. I might want to jump in there. I may not give the person the benefit of the doubt. Maybe it was a little more carefree comment. And I've taken it, you know, very, very personally. And I also like the idea that Christians want to change the discourse. One question for you. You know, I was born in the late 50s, and I grew up in the 60s and 70s. My parents were very interested in politics, so I used to watch the news. And it seemed to me that in politics in the 60s, even though it was a very controversial time, Vietnam War, lots of things, it seemed like the two-party system could reach across the aisle. You know, I mean, in 1956, Eisenhower and Stevenson probably differed on how to deal with the Soviet Union, maybe how to deal with taxes, but they shared a common worldview. Their view of America was quite similar. It seems today the worldview ideas have moved away from each other. Is that part of the scenario in your mind?
I think so. And I think, you know, Pew Research has done some interesting studies that just came out within the last week or so about this polarization. And again, it's constitutionally, it's meant to have different views, different strengths, different positions. You know, another really interesting thing was that I read a piece on teaching ethical thinking to kids. And this is by a very liberal professor, but he went to Appalachia State. They call it App. Yeah. And he found there's a number of things that are fascinating is that he's beginning to see that this not just the left-right divide. In fact, conservatives, you know, both sides are kind of against each other and all that. But there's this group of people called, you know, they're more libertarian, and they don't really identify with either. They actually have a more rational way of thinking about this rather than a right-wrong. So this black-white divide on everything that's polarizing us has actually been inflamed by a lot of social media stuff. The automated stuff on the extreme left and extreme right produces, by scholars, shows that 25 to 30 times the volume of regular mainstream actual political accounts. So Is it that there's really this divide, or is it that someone's inflaming it, both people that want to see it inflamed and foreign actors? And I think there's several of those things. And I agree. I think we need, as Americans, you know, first Christians, I mean, first we should be as Christ-like as we can in this, but we're also Americans, right? And we share this space, this political space. We ought to be the ones creating a better – we are the ones that help create the basis for civil discourse. Let's not contribute to its erosion.
Mark, is there a source you can guide people to that you'd recommend? Have you written an article in this area? Or do you plan to?
I haven't. It's more because I've taught a lot of this analytical and critical thinking at school. It was more because of the concerns I have about it, and I've been picking up some work. So I haven't written one. And I think if you're interested on the election interference, probably the best thing to get is the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. Just relate its analysis of the 2016 the Russian intervention. And there it includes a lot of the social media stuff. You could pick up a lot. But it also talks, of course, about foreign actors and what they're doing, how they're using social media platforms. And so it's kind of a good expose on both. And it has a lot of – you could, you know, crib the notes from that because they really document this well. And there's a lot of good research that's been put into this.
Joe, let's end on a personal note. Tell us a little bit about your wife, how long you've been married.
Sure.
The dynamic duo you have with her.
And we sign our letters MC squared, Mark and Mara Clark. So light speed. Just hope it doesn't always equal E equals MC squared. But we've been married. Mara and actually met Hugh and Kathy after, I think, about 1 year of marriage. So she's known Hugh and Kathy for a lot longer than I have.
Okay.
And then I met her first in Hugh's Paradoxes class back in 1989. And then we eventually got married in 1993. She's a marriage family therapist at Azusa Pacific. What's kind of fun is that although we're in two very different fields, a lot of her research into neuroscience and how it helps her understand therapy and psychology actually spills over into critical thinking and things like that. So I borrow kind of widely from different sources, but it's kind of fun because, you know, as they say, as we get older, we need to learn new things to keep our brains healthy.
Yeah.
And she got bored with her job. She got bored with herself. And then she began this. And it's been fun for me to encourage her learning, but also to learn from her and take some of this literature and incorporate it in what I'm doing.
Nice. So very good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up. We've had the pleasure of visiting with Dr. Mark Clark, Professor Emeritus of Political Science and Director of the National Security Studies Program at California State University, San Bernardino. We mentioned that book early on that the two of you are co-authors, along with Hugh Ross, Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, A Rational Christian Look at UFOs and Extraterrestrials. People might be interested in that just because you mentioned this. Storm 51?
Yes.
Storm.
UFOs now in the media.
You
wrote an article recently on that for our Voices feature on our website.
Yes.
So,
and then we had some on 2819 talks about it. But I would encourage everyone to really contact Ken. He's the expert in it. Contactees and abductions.
All right, Abductive reasoning, right? Okay. All right. Thanks for listening. We'd like to hear from you. Let us know your comments and questions. You can reach Ken on Twitter at @RTB_KSamples. This podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and Spotify. For the gang here, Ken Samples, Dave Rogstad, and Mark Clark, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory, but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Straight Thinking.
Thank you for listening. Your prayers and financial support are reaching people with reasons for faith in Jesus Christ, our Creator and Savior. To allow Reasons to Believe programs like this to continue, make your gift today at reasons.org.